Welcome to Chair Chat, an online web series hosted by me, Jamie Harrison, the chairman of the South Carolina Democratic Party. Our goal in this series is to begin to look at political leaders, activists, and people involved in politics in a three-dimensional manner. We will move past the political caricatures to get to know the individual. So now, let's chat. He camped out in drug-dealing neighborhoods in Newark. There was a documentary made about his race for mayor. He revolutionized the use of social media to address the needs of his constituents. From shoveling snow to running into burning buildings, my next guest became a political icon and a master of constituent service. He now is a member of the most powerful political body in the world. But I remember this guy running around the dining halls of Yale University in an old t-shirt and jogging pants. I am super excited to interview and welcome to Chair Chats my good friend, United States Senator Cory Booker. Welcome to Chair Chats.
It is great to be here. It's great to see you, for crying out loud.
It's so amazing to have you in South Carolina. I know we've been trying to do this for forever.
Yes.
And it's so good to have you here in my home state.
And the funny thing is like, you know, I meet lots of friends that, you know, you've known them for decades, and then you see them and we haven't aged well, but you look like the same guy with a little less hair.
I'm definitely losing in the hair department.
Yeah. But you were, you know, I was a law student, but I lived in the undergraduate dorm, Pearson College. And you were really one of my favorite souls. And I knew then that you were going to do special things in this world. But to see you in this really national leadership role, because whoever's the party chair in South Carolina, given presidential seasons like this, is a national figure. And I sat in Clyburn's office, Congressman Clyburn's, a couple days before I came down here, just to visit with him. I'm coming to his district. But the things he said about you would make you blush. He is such a fan of yours and just went through the kind of impact you've made beyond the sort of professional impact, but the spirit you've brought to this job. And that just made me swell with pride.
Oh, that makes my heart patter, and I really appreciate that, and appreciate hearing from you, because you have, I mean, when I talk to old Yale friends, they always ask, oh, when's the last time you've seen Cory? And they are so excited and so proud of what you have done and what you've accomplished, going from mayor of Newark to the United States Senate. And the horizon is still there. You know, there's still so much more for you to accomplish. And I think people are just beaming with pride on how well you have done. And all that you're accomplishing for the country. So
I'm grateful for you saying that. Thank you, man.
Yeah.
So let's just go back a little bit. So I remember right when you're getting ready to graduate from Yale, and you had this dilemma. And I think it's the dilemma that a lot of young people have. It is whether or not you should go to the law firm or you know, go to an investment banking or investment bank or do some type of consulting, or whether to go and do some work in the community. And so so you graduated from law school and then you went to Newark to become a program coordinator at a community organization. And you decided to camp out in, you know, drug-infested neighborhoods where they were drug dealing and all. Why did you make that choice?
Well, for me, I was raised by these parents who worked in corporate America, but raised my brother and I to understand that we came from a place where we owe a debt, you know.
Yeah.
And you know this. My father was born in poverty to a single mom. He used to always say, son, I was too poor to be poor. I was just P-O. I couldn't afford the other two letters. And he would detail all the incredible things and interventions that had to happen from him to go from poverty in the South to being in this middle-class northeastern neighborhood.
Yeah. And where did he grow up in the South?
He grew up in Hendersonville, North Carolina.
Okay.
It's just this amazing community I've gone back to. But the stories are tough. And so when you see how that community pulled together, when his mama couldn't take care of him, this amazing family brought him into their home, roof over his head, how much his church helped him, how much they got a kid that had no college tradition, off to North Carolina Central University, how the civil rights movement at that point buoyed and carried, lifted him up to the point where he was landing in Washington, D.C., and all these people were fighting, blacks and whites, to get blacks hired by corporate America for the first time. And he started becoming a trailblazer, first black hire for this company, and then became, in the Virginia area, the first black salesman hired. Wow. And so my father kept telling me over and over again growing up, then when he moved to New Jersey, they wouldn't let black families, real estate agents would steer black families away from the neighborhoods, the neighborhood really I eventually grew up in. And it had to be this intervention where a white test couple went up after my parents told me the house was sold, a big altercation where my father's lawyer was attacked. Finally, we move into this neighborhood, as my father used to call us, the four raisins in a tub of sweet vanilla ice cream. And, you know, so this was my father, as I was growing up, would never let me forget who I was and where I came for and the debt I owed that I could never pay back but had to pay forward.
Yeah.
And so by the time I'm 18 years old, you know, I had a life that was beyond what my father could even conceive of. A full scholarship to Stanford University, just an incredibly nurturing community. And he just said, these blessings, you know, you drink deeply from wells of freedom and liberty that you didn't dig. You eat lavishly from banquet tables prepared for you by your ancestors. You can't just sit back getting dumb, fat, and happy, consuming all these blessings. Yeah. They can metabolize you to do something good. So by the time I got to Yale, I fell in love with working in the clinics, helping to run some of the sort of free legal clinics for the community, and just felt that this was my calling and wanted to find a neighborhood that reflected that. And so I said, I'm a Jersey boy, so let me go back home. But not even home to the sort of affluent community I came from, but let me go to the toughest place where people tell you not to go. And I went to this really tough neighborhood and moved into some high-rise projects where I lived for about 8 years and just partnered with incredible leaders in that community to try to fight for change. Yeah. And we were able to make some really good strides.
Well, so you're in South Carolina this week because you're doing some campaign events for Secretary Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so,
who you've chair chatted with?
Who I've chair chatted with? She sat right in that chair.
Ooh, okay. I feel presidential suddenly.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, Bernie Sanders sat there too, and Martin O'Malley. Yeah.
I know all three. I've benefited from knowing all three for a long time. Yeah. Well, except for Bernie, I've known him for just 2 years in the Senate, and have respect. It's a great thing to be a Democratic Party and find three people who have such solid records.
Yeah. So one of my questions is, why did you decide, given that you know all three, why did you decide that Secretary Clinton was, you thought, the best to be the next president of the United States?
Well, it's more than that. It was more than just an intellectual decision. Yeah. There's an old saying, who you are speaks so loudly, I can't hear what you say.
Oh, yeah.
And so connecting with her, I saw a spirit there. Mm-hmm. A goodness that inspired me when I connected sort of her authenticity with qualifications for the office that nobody has, Republicans or Democrats. Nobody has sort of done her grassroots Children's Defense Fund, coming out of law school like I did, not going to the big corporate law firms, not making the big money, but going into the trenches right away. Her experience as First Lady, her experience as United States Senator, her experience, global experience as Secretary of State. All of these things have really made her so prepared for the office. And when she combined that resume with a passionate, authentic connection to the issues that matter to people, by the way, not the issues necessarily that poll well, but issues of addiction, issues of criminal justice reform, kitchen table issues about just the practical sense of how is a middle-class family going to be able to have more money at the end of the month and find themselves with more month at the end of their money. Mm-hmm. And so when I started seeing that combination, which is rare, I was like, I'm in on this. And then for have her be someone who, to me, just spoke to issues that I know are real from having been a mayor and struggling in communities, that all combined to say, hey, you know what, Secretary Clinton, I am a soldier. Put me to work for you.
So one of the things I would like to ask you also, you have another friend or there's someone who you work with a lot who's also running, Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey. What are your thoughts about his campaign so far?
Well, first of all, this is the strangest presidential election of my life because now there are people I know pretty well on both sides. I work with Rubio. I work with Ted Cruz. I mean, he's one of the first people I had dinner with in Washington, D.C. I know Chris Christie. I've gotten to know Jeb Bush. He and I were on a board together. So it's interesting now to know, first time in my life, I know presidential candidates, all the Democrats, a good number of the Republicans. Even the New York Times posted a picture of me and Donald Trump together because I got to know him around Jersey. And so I know some of his family really well. So this is one of those times where I have the privilege, I think, to not only know them on their policies, but know them as individuals. And so Chris Christie, you asked about specifically, he and I have worked together, had to. I was mayor of the largest city in the state. Yeah. He was the governor. We disagree on, I could write a dissertation on our disagreements, but we had to find areas of commonality to move my city forward during a time of economic recession. So, it's interesting to see them all now making a national pitch.
Well, maybe one day you can be the person that brings everybody into the room and say, can't we all just get along?
Well, I've had to play that role already. So the busiest river crossing in America is actually the Hudson River.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to do this massive infrastructure project. And so just trying to get everybody to come together on both sides of the rivers, two governors, two different parties, four senators, national figures like a former mayor, now Secretary Fox, who's Secretary of Transportation. That's part of the job in leadership is trying to bring folk together and to have a nation that as I did with Christie, at the end of the day, our differences matter, but our nation matters more.
Well, you mentioned Secretary Fox. So this is something, just recently I had a reporter say to me, Secretary Clinton is leading in South Carolina, and odds are if the polls hold, and she will win South Carolina, and possibly that will help her secure the nomination. So then we will shift to who will be her vice presidential nominee, and they asked, well, who do you think? And I said, well, 9 times out of 10, she probably won't. It'll probably be a male because I don't know if she would pick a female. She's breaking the glass ceiling, but there's the politics. And I said, so then it's either white male, Hispanic male, African American male, or Asian male. And they said, well, who are your thoughts? I said, oh, if it's a white male, then maybe Tim Kaine from Virginia.
Yes.
Right. Great guy, speaks Spanish, was a governor. I said, in Hispanic males, of course, conventional wisdom, Castro brother, Secretary Castro. But I said, maybe Javier Becerra, who is a congressman from California. And they said, well, what if it's African American? And I said, there are two people that come to mind, but there's one that I will root for. I said, Secretary Fox, of course, mayor from Charlotte. And the other one is a Rhodes Scholar, an All-American football player from Stanford, Yale law grad, who hails from the great state of New Jersey, Cory Booker. So, Senator, would you ever consider if Secretary Clinton told you after she has a nomination, here's my short list of people that I am thinking about for vice president, and you're one of them.
Well, she gave me her short list. I would tell you right now, I would give an endorsement to Tim Kaine like he's never heard. I've served with him. I have a reverence for him that's incredible. Some of the other names are out there, like one of the Castro brothers. Yeah. I know those guys. They're both, Stanford guys. And so for me, it's about our team needs to win.
Yes.
Never before have I understood the urgency of us retaining the White House now that I'm in the Senate and I see all those little things that matter so much.
Yeah.
So that's my goal here is to win. It's flattering to be named like that, especially from old friends like you. It's really flattering. But more important than me or anyone being vice president is that Hillary Clinton's the president.
Right.
And that, to me, is the most critical victory that I'm seeking. And right now I'm just like, I'm a yeoman. I have no ego in this. Put me anywhere.
Put me on the field.
All I want to do is be in the. I don't even care if I'm not on the field. I'll be a bat boy. I want to be contributing to the success of the team.
Well, I also want to talk with you a little bit on the personal side.
You know what's amazing? And first of all, we talk a lot about issues in this politics. Yeah. in this campaign, the arts won't be talked about nearly as much as it should.
I agree.
What it does for people to elevate you, the arts to inspire you, to motivate you, to cultivate your dreams, to nurture your injuries. And I always tell people that it's art that the reason why I'm here, because my father, who's named Carrie Alfred Booker, his poor North Carolina mama, uh-huh, loved the movies,
yeah,
and named him after Cary Grant and Alfred Hitchcock. And so my father tells the stories of going up to the black segregated balcony.
Yeah.
And this shows you how important art is in our communities. He would watch movies, and one day, a little boy saw a movie about Manhattan and a salesman in Manhattan, and it planted a dream that one day he would be a salesman. And then next thing you know, he's working for one of the most important global corporations of his time, IBM, as a salesman in Manhattan, as one of the top salesmen. So it just shows you that engagement in the arts, and then you and I both have been shaped not just by musicians, but we've been shaped by the poetry of Langston Hughes and Maya Angelou. We've been shaped by the artistry of some of the greatest thinkers and geniuses. So I just love that you are unabashed about the impact that music makes in our lives. And I just did a mix on Spotify of music that made me feel my father, because I put, you know, it was a mix of Otis Redding, Ray Charles, and Satchmo. And I was listening to some of his greats
So who's your favorite?
You know, I'm like the most eclectic music lover there is. And it's embarrassing because a couple of my staffers who helped me set my Spotify have a window into what I listen to. Uh-huh. And they just chuckle because it's everything from old classics like that. You know, I was having a Nina Simone morning the other morning and just really, really getting into it. But then the next thing you know, I'll be listening to Bruce Springsteen and John Bon Jovi.
Yeah.
You know, I'll work out to the musicals. I love Hamilton is the new hot musical.
Yeah.
And there's this great song, Alexander Hamilton, and I was using that to work out to. So I'm all over the place. When you create the soundtrack of your life, it really does influence your moods. And both you and I have had our moods shift.
Oh yeah.
And we've bonded over. We have a mutual friend who I just used to. It was like one of the more delights I have to watch her squeal over Prince. and just sit in right below where my dorm room was. She would sit in that basement with you often and watch like Purple Rain for the 20th time or 200th time, I should probably say. And Prince was one of my favorites growing up well.
One of the sad moments when I think about Michael Jackson's life is that Michael Jackson and Prince never did something together.
Well, the joke was they were going to have a dance off back in the day, since everybody wanted to see.
And
MC Hammer, don't forget about these people you always talk about. Who would win?
you're a vegan. Communications director would kill me if I didn't ask you this. You're a vegan.
Yes.
And
is that do they arrest vegans here in South Carolina?
Oh, God.
Yeah. She thinks they do. So one of the things she wanted to know, in D.C., what's your favorite restaurant?
Oh, my gosh. There is so much vegan options in D.C., from a restaurant called Sticky Rice to Rasika to...
Rasika. Oh, my in-laws love Rasika.
Yeah, they have this spinach.
The fried spinach.
It's like crack cocaine.
Oh,
they did.
I was just talking about it the other night. You just have to eat it.
It is ridiculously good.
It really is.
I mean, so it is. The problem is I got to D.C. and now I'm back on the wagon, but I gained weight.
Yeah.
Heaviest I'd ever been in my life was my first year or so as senator. And so now I'm battling back. And so I'm trying to stay away from the fried spinach.
You know, for me, it was moving back here to South Carolina. It was just the carbs, the sweet tea, and you go out for barbecue, and you got to get the hush puppies, and then my wife.
Challenge.
Yeah,
this is a challenge. Be honest. I was on the board of Michael Bloomberg's foundation, and it's an incredible foundation. It does so much work just to save human lives, from non-smoking campaigns in developing nations to traffic helmet efforts in developing nations. Just look, how can we save and elevate human life? And one day they had a slide on the board of life expectancy rates going up healthy and well for every group except for black men.
Yeah.
And there's this wonderful guy, just watch his TED Talk, I really recommend it. I think it's Ron Finley.
Mm-hmm.
If you just put in the Gorilla Gardener, he was saying that in South Central, we have drive-bys and drive-throughs, and the drive-throughs are killing more people than the drive-bys.
Wow.
And I'm telling you right now, people don't understand this. We talk about violence. If you look at the rates of heart disease, diabetes, it is epidemic in Black communities, epidemic across our country generally. But for Black men like you and me, we have terrible, terrible health outcomes. Yeah. And so what my hope is this coming year, 2016, I can begin to be the change I want to see in the world. Yeah. And it's just so important that we, in positions, we're privileged enough that people want to see what we tweet, want to see our chair chats, to begin to think about small changes in our diet we can make and our lifestyles that we can make that will have big differences in extending our lives. Because it's just Americans have eating patterns that make us very unhealthy compared to other countries globally. And what's even worse than that, the environmental impact of what we eat is not sustainable. If every country in the globe ate like the Western American diet, we would need four planet Earths just to sustain this globe. And so for me, the reason why I became vegan was not, I'm not one of those people, if you and I were sitting down and you were eating fried chicken and I was eating my fried spinach, I would have no problem with what you're doing. But I just thought to myself, you know what, how can I better align my values to my personal choices? And it was just, it's always a personal choice. And we should always think about it. The most powerful vote we have, and people don't realize, because unfortunately not enough people vote in elections. And I want to say this directly to the camera. It's appalling, the voting rates here in South Carolina. It's appalling what they are in New Jersey as well, especially knowing how many people had to suffer and die for this. So that's something that just almost hurts me when I think about our history. Yeah. But people don't realize we do vote, though, every day with our dollars.
Yes.
How we spend our money, it's one of the best reflection of our values. Not what we say we believe in, but what we do. Yeah. Like, and sometimes I stop and think, and I try to educate myself, like, where do the clothes come?
Yeah.
Who made them? What were the working conditions of the people that made them? When I go to eat, most people don't think about this, but the minimum wage for tipped workers, $2.13. We spend billions of dollars as taxpayers supporting these industries because they don't pay their workers enough, so we have to pay for food stamps. We have to pay for public housing.
Right.
And so when you start being conscious of your consumerism and how you vote with your dollars. Am I deciding to stop at a store that pays their workers right or not? Am I going to buy some food that was made sustainably, free range chicken, or not?
Yeah.
And that's where this public-private partnership is so important because I'm now seeing companies, even Walmart, changing a lot of their practices because they realize that they are an affront to their American values. Well, we have that power every single day. And this you and I both know from campaigning. When we decide to live by our values, we elevate other people and give them the courage to live by their values as well.
That's exactly right.
And we know this from our data. I could come to South Carolina 10 times, talk to people about voting. I might have some influence. I probably imagine I have more than I do. But the most powerful influence on a person to vote is their peer group.
Exactly right.
And so that's we impact people all over. Like, my brother just lost 70 pounds. And I'm looking at him. One of the reasons I'm doing what I'm doing right now is, like, I am not going to let that brother look as sexy as he does. And then now I'm going to be called the fat man, the fat one. So you influence the people around you just by making a determined decision. I'm going to change one habit in my life. You have a ripple effect on the people around you. Just by telling people, you know what, I'm going to eat a little less fried food, doing it and talking about it means the people around you are going to be influenced by that decision. Alice Walker has this statement. She says, the most common way people give up their power is not realizing they have it in the first place.
Wow.
And so we have power to influence an effect that's far more, and by the way, more than the people in the 60s and civil rights movement, because now we can post about it on Twitter.
Exactly right.
And friends begin to say, oh, wait a minute, what's Jamie doing? You know, and that's why I hope more people understand that, forget changing the world. I made the mistake coming out of law school thinking I was going to transform the world when I realized the most important thing I can do is live by my values, transform myself, and then maybe that will ripple out and change the world.
Speaking of values, and this is the last question, and so I can let you go. American values, the situation that's going on right now in Paris and with the refugees in Syria. And many folks, I know pretty soon the United States Senate will take up a debate and discussion about whether or not America will allow Syrian refugees into, continue to allow the refugees into the country. Where are you on this particular issue, and where do you think America needs to be on this?
Well, first of all, let's just understand that people who, on all sides of this debate, when you talk to real Americans, they're concerned, they're fearful, they watch what happened in France, they remember some of the things that have happened in America. Yeah. You could see the world, I'm 12 miles away from ground zero, and you could see it from where I lived. So anybody who discounts that fear is making a mistake and doesn't want to address it with substantive policy that makes us safer. And by the way, we can and should get better every single day.
Exactly.
And Americans should be upset because we haven't done a good enough job. When they test TSA and find out that they 90% of the stuff that the testers try to smuggle through, they're actually getting through, shows America should be doing a better job. So the first most important thing is our safety and security. But at the same time, I will never sacrifice my values, freedom of speech, privacy, for security. As soon as you make an exchange for your freedoms and your values for your security, you end up losing both.
Yeah.
And so we need to figure out a way to make sure we keep this country safe. Now, there's a falseness in this debate going on right now in Washington that people need to understand. And the falseness in this debate is, are there things we can do to improve the refugee program? Yes, and we've talked about them. I came from a hearing on Thursday where we talked about this. But the falseness in this debate is, if you look at the 10 different ways to get into America, student visas, tourist visas, the visa waiver program, crossing the borders in the south of the north, the hardest way to get into America right now, the most vetted you will be the refugee program.
Yeah.
If I'm a terrorist and thinking to myself, I need to get into America, I'm not going to go through a two-year program with all that's involved. It's easier to get in other ways. And so for people to zone in on this and create something that's not true, when you look at the vetting process, when you look at the level of scrutiny, and say, wait a minute, if they came with a bill on the visa waiver program, because please understand, about 5,000 countries, now for those who don't understand what the visa waiver program is, people from France don't need to get a visa to come into the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have an open exchange. It's easy for a French tourist to come here. And so they're a visa-waived a country. Well, what happens with those countries when those countries are sourcing fighters in Syria, and then those people come back to France? About 5,000 foreign fighters going to ISIS are coming from our visa waiver countries.
Wow.
That means if those folks are radicalized in France, they can just come to our country as tourists.
Exactly right.
And so we're talking about a refugee program that takes 18 months to 2 years to get here. And the way they test these folks, how hard it is, and most people don't realize our refugee program takes the most vulnerable people, women, children, victims of torture. We don't take just the full group of what we zone in on those people, and the foreign, the fighter, military-aged men, single foreign, are like barely a blip in our program.
Yeah.
So if people were in Washington were now talking about, wait a minute, let's rush to put legislation in to tighten up the visa waiver program. Let's start making intelligence sharing about those people coming in from their countries more up to date. There's so many things we could be doing to improve these things. There are real holes.
Yeah.
So this to me is a bit of a false a concern that seems to me often more about political pandering than the substance of protecting our country and the things that we should be doing. Let me give you a couple more examples. We have departments that have suffered because of the sequester funding cuts. FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, a lot of these folks, places that should be getting resources. Now, we resource our military overseas, which is important, but we're letting a lot of these folks starve when we should be doing more investment in them. Let me give you another example. Why I know, I became mayor and I said, you know what? If I had to speak honestly about guns in America, I'm going to tell you right now that I could only find one shooting in Newark that was done with a guy or a woman that bought a gun legally. So I'm not worried about you going out and buying weapons. I'm worried about you because your increases of that gun being used on yourself, accidents, mistakes, I'm worried about that because you're my friend and I love you. But law-abiding citizens in this country, by and large, are not committing the most of the murders going on in our country. But what worries me is how easy it is for criminals to get weapons. Now, just your grade A American criminal is bad.
Yes.
Horrific. But now think about the terrorist attacks in Mumbai, in Nigeria, mm-hmm. and in France. These were men with automatic weapons. So imagine now you are a foreigner on a visa, come in here on a wave from a wave visa, come a radicalized person in Belgium who gets a visa to come here and visit, can walk into a gun dealership
and buy a weapon.
And buy automatic weapons.
And there was just a video from the terrorist groups that talked about the ease of buying weapons in the United States.
So we're all this focus on a refugee, on the heart, and I'm not saying we shouldn't be focused on it, but all this focus on the hardest way to get into this country, and yet nobody wants to talk about how easy it is for foreign nationals to buy weapons in this country. Nobody wants to talk about the other challenges we have. Student visa programs, visa waiver countries, all of these things where we should be focused on improving. And so I am not political in this. I just want to keep my constituency safe. Yeah. And I definitely don't want to be the country when Canada is taking many times more refugees than we are. When France, days after the terrorist attacks, France says we are still going to take tens of thousands of refugees. So please hear this, America.
Yeah.
We are the light and the beacon. We are the Statue of Liberty country that says, give us your tired, your weak, your harmless, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. That's our motto. Not France, not Canada. That's who we are. So I will never sacrifice the truth of who we are. I'm going to be vigilant about keeping us safe and not get into political pandering, but focus on the areas that really need to be beefed up.
Well, Senator, I tell you, wow, that was powerful. And there's a reason why I always tell people that I am very happy about the future of the Democratic Party. And it's because we have leaders like you who are representing us in the United States Senate. Thank you so much for being a part of Chair Chats.
Stop for a second, because I don't want you to close out without me closing out and just saying this. You, my friend, first of all, I love this man. He is. How does South Carolina know how lucky they are to have you? Because you have options, too. You and I both know that. You could probably do something, make more money. You could probably have offers all around this country. But your loyalty and dedication to here. I know your wife sometimes says, you're doing what? Doing this again? We got a newborn baby here. Look at you're leaving your child. But yet you are so dedicated to public service. And you're not party politics. You're doing this, and I know this because I know you. You're doing this because of the values, the issues, the ideas that you think are so important in South Carolina. So, to me, and I don't use this word liberally, I really think you're a heroic person. And the great thing about you, you're so damn young, is that God hasn't finished with you yet, and great things are ahead. So I've been honored to know you for all these years, and I just want to say I am grateful that you are a leader in our country.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. I appreciate it. And I appreciate you calling me young because, you know, I'm hitting 40 next year. I need that positive reinforcement. Thank you again for being on Chair Chats, and it's so good to have you here.
It's great to have you.
And thank you, because you're always welcome on Chair Chats.